Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, there's been a change of policy in Germany on the flood of migrants. Our correspondent is on the scene. We'll take a closer look at renewed tensions in Jerusalem. An author shares her thoughts on having everything just so.
With perfectionism, our whole identity gets tied up in our efforts, our appearance, our relationships.
And a new sound from a band's imagination and two top producers. It's right here on The Voice of America. The flood of refugees from the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia continues to plague Europe. Correspondent Luis Ramirez is in Munich, Germany, to observe the situation there and joins us on the line. Welcome, Luis.
Hello, Susan. A very different situation in Munich from what it has been in recent days. Essentially, what has happened is that with the German government's policy changes, imposing border restrictions, restricting the trains coming from Vienna to Munich, that has meant a really significant reduction in the number of migrants coming into Munich. This had been the entry point in, you know, the migrants who I interviewed in Serbia, Hungary, and Austria. The vast majority said they wanted to come to Germany, and Munich was where they wanted to stop first. Well, the situation at the Munich Central train station on Monday, again, vastly different. Very few migrants coming through. In fact, more volunteers at a refugee reception center that was set up inside the train station than refugees themselves. The donations have kept pouring in, but really there are more donations than refugees to give them to.
What arrangements are being made for the migrants that are already there?
The German government has very efficiently been transferring them either by bus or train to resettlement points throughout Germany. In other words, the government is not allowing them to stay in large numbers in Munich itself. The authorities in the city have said that they were not overwhelmed, but certainly at capacity in terms of dealing with them as they pass through here. But very few have actually resettled in Munich itself. They're going to areas throughout Germany where reception centers, registration centers have been set up to give them temporary housing to help them settle into their new lives in this country.
It appears from here that maybe they're thinking these people will be staying permanently rather going back to their home countries eventually.
That's a decision that the government in Germany and other places are having to make because, well, the question that these people are being asked that authorities are trying to determine is whether they are migrants or refugees. The difference being that refugees are people who are granted asylum, who cannot go back to their homelands because they face threats to their lives, versus migrants, economic migrants, who are looking for a better life, better jobs, a better economic situation.
The migrants that you have had a chance to speak with in Germany, what are they telling you?
There is a great deal of uncertainty with these policy changes on the border restrictions. There is a lack of trust in what the government plans to do for them, and that explains partly why we saw very few of them at the refugee center at the train station. Some volunteers explaining to us that essentially people are afraid that they could be rounded up and deported if they are concentrated in one place. So a number of them have dispersed on their own, and the others are already at registration centers around the country, as I mentioned.
They must be very happy that they reached Germany.
They certainly are, and in fact, my next stop is going to be the German border with Austria, where we are getting word of hundreds of people who are massing there, coming in from Austria and beyond that from Hungary. With the new border restrictions and Germany rethinking its strategy on how it's going to accept and absorb the thousands who are coming in, the authorities, we're getting reports, are being pulled off trains at the border. There are traffic jams at the border, with many of them finding transportation by car or bus to try to reach Munich and points beyond.
Thank you very much for your sharing with us what you found there in Munich.
Thank you, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is social media reporter Andrew Palchewski. And welcome, Andrew. What do you got for us this hour?
Well, there's some big trending topics. Hashtag LibSpill and Tony Abbott. Tony Abbott is, of course, the Prime Minister of Australia. He is out. Malcolm Turnbull is in as the new Prime Minister. And hashtag LibSpill is about this Liberal Party, what they call a leadership spill. They had a leadership vote and they ousted Tony Abbott as the leader of the Liberal Party and thus ousted him as Prime Minister.
And you were mentioning a minute ago that this is a kind of something that everybody in the world is interested in now. It's social media has made the whole planet all connected.
Oh, absolutely. It's a top trending topic in the U.S. It's a top trending topic in a couple other countries. And it's well past bedtime for Australians,
right.
So they're not tweeting about it anymore. It's everybody else in the world. And there's some interesting takes on it. It's a lot of people noting it's the fifth prime minister that Australia has had in 5 years. So people saying they change their prime ministers, you know, every season. It's like, you know, getting a new, you know, coat or sweater or something. You go, you know, whatever is in season. Somebody in the U.S. saying U.S. presidents have a max of 2 terms. Aussie prime ministers can't even get through one. And then a lot of people have the sentiment that said, well, Australia's politics is a lot more interesting than ours in our home country. So that, again, as you said, speaks to the global nature of social media. A lot of people taking it and making it about them and focusing it on their country and giving it their own perspective. So great information sharing.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have discovered an incredibly massive and productive galaxy cluster located about 9.8 billion light years from Earth in the Ursa Major constellation. The galaxy cluster is named 1049 plus 56, and one of its most interesting qualities is its ability to produce new stars at an extraordinary rate. Galaxy clusters are parts of the universe where hundreds of galaxies group together and are bound to each other through gravity. The newly discovered galaxy cluster contains at least 27 galaxies and has a total mass equal to about 400 trillion suns. It's producing more than 860 stars per year. By comparison, our own Milky Way galaxy creates only 1 star each year. The astronomers were able to make the discovery with a combination of observatories. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
There are renewed tensions in Jerusalem amid a second day of clashes at the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex following an overnight rock-throwing incident that killed the driver of a vehicle returning from a meal marking the Jewish New Year. The driver lost control of the vehicle in a Jerusalem neighborhood and crashed into an electrical pole, injuring 2 passengers. My colleague Victor Beatty has been following the tensions in Jerusalem, and he joins me now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, Israeli police entered the Al-Aqsa Mosque early Sunday to remove barricades that prevented Jews and tourists from visiting the site, and said they were attacked by masked youths throwing stones and fireworks. Police cleared the area of people and reopened the site. Palestinians say several were injured. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the police raid. Al-Aqsa is one of Islam's holiest sites and is in the Temple Mount complex, also revered by Jews. It's long been a source of religious and political tension. Regional analyst Michael Fishbeck of Randolph-Macon College in Virginia told me tensions have been high since a Palestinian family was killed in a firebombing at 2 West Bank homes by suspected Jewish settlers back in July.
From the Palestinian side, there's been a considerable amount of rage, particularly among West Bank Palestinians, and that would in the occupied territories, and that would include East Jerusalem, over the deaths, the burning deaths of a family that occurred as a result of an attack by Israeli settlers a number of weeks ago. There was an infant who was burned and killed almost immediately. The father lingered on for about a week or two. And just in the past week, the mother, after lingering in the hospital for a number of weeks, finally died. For Palestinians, emotions and political feelings have been particularly high. And so coinciding with it did, as Jews flock into Jerusalem for the Jewish holidays, it's unfortunately not a surprise that this occurred when it did.
There are some in Israel who want Jews to be allowed to pray there, but apparently now they're not allowed to.
No, since 1967, that's been the case. There are 2 dimensions to that. The one is that for ultra-religious Jews, it is forbidden to go anywhere on that complex because they believe it's somewhere on that complex, which now houses the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as a shrine, a very beautiful shrine known as the Dome of the Rock. That somewhere in that esplanade is where the Hebrew temple stood 2,000 years ago. And somewhere within that temple complex is where the Holy of Holies stood, which is where the actual presence of God was. So for religious Jews, it is forbidden to go up there because you might accidentally step on the Holy of Holies. So religious Jews don't go up there. On the other hand, you have the Israeli government trying to limit political problems over Jews trying to pray there because there's a great fear among Muslim Palestinians that, and in fact, these are not idle fears. They've been articulated by various right-wing Jewish organizations that someday they intend to demolish those shrines and mosques and rebuild the Jewish temple.
Well, of course, this whole issue of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute has been pushed to the back pages with regard to other events like the Iran nuclear negotiations, the European migrant crisis, and other situations. What's the status right now?
The world's attention is still on Middle Eastern events, but questions related to Syrian refugees, with the kind of anarchist movement among Kurds in northern Syria who have created really their own free territory, the Iran deal, and the prospect that, you know, billions of dollars in either frozen funds or new investment money is going to flow to Iran, frankly overshadowed the Arab-Israeli peace process. With American elections coming up, I think there is a frustration that happens a lot among Palestinians that, you know, if there's no crisis, the world forgets that there's a problem here.
The last U.S. effort to forge some sort of peace agreement between Israelis and Palestinians collapsed in April 2014 with no understanding reached on the core issues of Jewish settlements in occupied territories, future borders, and the status of Jerusalem. Fishbeck says as U.S. peace efforts over the past four decades have failed, absent some incentive for both sides to reach a deal, an agreement will likely remain elusive.
Thank you for that report, Victor.
All right, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, the downside of perfect, and the band Perry has something new for its fans. Being a perfectionist is not always a good thing. Sure, you get everything just right, exactly the way you want it, but it can cause trouble too. Dr. Jane Bluestein has written a new book about it called The Perfection Deception, and she joins us now on the line. Welcome, Jane.
Hi.
That's a really cute title you've got there.
I wish I could take credit for that. That was I just write the books. They come up with the clever title.
Well, it's a good one. Hey, Alyssa, what is the downside to perfectionism?
Well, there are a lot of them. What you're talking about is really looking, what we're looking for instead is really the pursuit of excellence, you know, really trying to do our best. The downside is with perfectionism, our whole identity gets tied up in our efforts, our appearance, our relationships. And then we try to control things that we don't always have a lot of control over. So if I can only be worthwhile in my mind, if I have this belief that I'm only lovable and safe and worthwhile, if I'm not making mistakes, I'm either likely to not try something, I'm likely to give up if I don't succeed the first time, which, you know, quite frankly, most of us don't. When we're doing something new, or if I'm with somebody who, you know, maybe doesn't have his shirt tucked in right, or doesn't look the way I think she should look, or whatever, it really can ruin your life because it takes all the joy out of pursuing new experiences, and it certainly is a real downer in a relationship.
Well, is perfectionism something you have or you don't? Can you stop being a perfectionist if you are already?
Well, you know, that's a great question because I can be really perfectionistic about certain things and really not care about others. So it's not like a switch that's on and off. And in fact, I've worked through an awful lot of my perfectionistic issues. But boy, writing this book brought a lot of them back up. So it's like a constant project. And I don't know that there's an off switch. You know, I started the fourth section with, which is about really healing and kind of not letting perfectionism run our lives, with my wish that I had a cure for it. What I have found in 2 years of interviewing hundreds of people who've wrestled with this issue is more that they have found ways to, you know, to manage the impact that it had, the negative impact, of course, that it has on their lives.
Well, how is the media contributing to the rise in perfectionism in people?
Well, the media is certainly, you know, would be very easy to blame for it all, but it's only one factor. And part of the, you know, the barrage of images that we're constantly getting about how we should look, how our home should look, what kind of car we're going to drive, and if we just do this, we'll be happy. If we can, you know, just go on this diet, or if we can just get this degree, or whatever. And there's always this promise that something, if we can just manage to get our own bodies into this size, shape, career, or whatever, that we'll be happy. There's always this payoff promised at the end. And so we look at people in ads, especially print ads, where, you know, they've all been airbrushed and photoshopped and stretched where they don't even look like the people in them anymore. And we think, oh, that's what I'm supposed to look like. And how many people, men and women, are starving themselves or doing surgery or doing, you know, really harmful things to their bodies, thinking that they will be more lovable and acceptable if they just look like this person who doesn't even look like who they really are.
And the clever name of your book again?
The Perfection Deception.
Great. Thank you so much, Jane, for joining us today.
Thank you, Susie. It was great talking to you.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Grammy winners The Band Perry, siblings Kimberly, Reed, and Neil, have been nominated for a CMA Award in the Vocal Group of the Year category. But their latest single, Live Forever, is more a pop song than their traditional newgrass country. International Edition's David Byrd reports that the new sound came from the band's imagination and from working with top producers, Red One and Diplo.
If I die young, bury me in satin, lay me down on a bed of roses, sink me in the river at dawn, send me away with the words of a love song.
The band Perry, lead singer Kimberly and her brothers Reed and Neil, is known for its close harmonies, strong lyrics, and its bluegrass roots. Their breakout hit, If I Die Young, is a multi-platinum single and launched the group into country music stardom. But Kimberly Perry and her brothers have departed from that more traditional sound in their new single, Live Forever.
I was dreaming of war, saw that I wouldn't die. Was dreaming of shores that my ship would find.
That new sound is a result of the group's work with Lady Gaga's producer, Red One, who also produced Nicki Minaj's Starship. Kimberly Perry says that Red One's talent for teaming gigantic melodies with powerful lyrics to produce anthem-like songs was just what the band wanted.
That was one reason that we were really excited to work with him because, of course, coming from country music, you know, country's really all about the narrative. So we were interested in putting a really narrative lyric with a gigantic melody that made everybody who heard it really want to sing along with it. And so, you know, we brought our narration into the room and Red One brought Big Melody and Live Forever was born. We're gonna live.
The group also worked with producer Diplo, who has worked with Britney Spears, Shakira, Beyonce, No Doubt, Justin Bieber, Usher, Snoop Dogg, and Chris Brown. Neil Perry, who plays mandolin in the band, says it was an exciting change for Diplo to record the acoustic-based band.
You know, it is interesting, too, to hear how a guy who wouldn't typically record organic instruments like mandolins,
banjo,
three-part family harmony, see how he would interpret that. And I think it made for some really unique sounds that will make this next album a step up from where Pioneer was. Yeah, we're gonna live.
The band Perry has not named their new album, and they have not announced its release date yet. But Kimberly Perry has said that the group was dreaming in color when they recorded the album, and the video for Live Forever is awash in bright yellow and other neon colors. Kimberly says that brightness and excitement is an indication of the flavor that fans can look for. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you'd like to listen to today's program, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Well over 4 million Syrians have fled the violence in their country. Most have found refuge in neighboring countries, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and Egypt. But as both the security forces loyal to Bashar al-Assad and violent extremist groups such as Daesh continue to target the civilian population, more and more people flee across the border. Syria's immediate neighbors already host such high numbers of refugees that the strain on their resources and communities is palpable. For example, Turkey now hosts over 2 million of the displaced, while, according to the government of Jordan, refugees now constitute over 20% of Jordan's population. So many of the Syrians have made the difficult decision to keep moving. Thousands of people, including entire multi-generational families, are now traveling through the Balkans and into Central Europe, hoping to reach a place where they can live productive and dignified lives until the killing ends in their home country. They are seeking safe haven in the many European countries which are now in the process of deciding how many refugees they can host and are gathering their resources to help. The United States is also committed to maintaining a robust refugee admissions program and is particularly aware of the needs of the Syrian refugee population. The president has determined that the administration will accept at least 10,000 Syrian refugees in the coming year. In the meantime, the United States is working in support of those countries that are already hosting large numbers of asylum seekers from Syria, particularly Syria's immediate neighbors. We are also sending aid to the millions of people who are in immediate need of humanitarian assistance inside Syria, including many who are internally displaced. To date, the United States has provided over $4.1 billion in humanitarian assistance since the start of the crisis. Most importantly, we are working through diplomatic channels towards a peaceful political resolution of Syria's conflict, because in the end, the vast majority of the refugees would someday like to return home. What is to happen eventually, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby, is a political transition in Syria so that the Syrian people can have a home which is safe and secure.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.